Good evening and welcome to tonight's program hosted by the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley. My name is Jenny Dearborn, Senior Vice President and Chief Learning Officer at SAP. It's my pleasure to introduce Dr. Kelly McGonigal, author of The Upside of Stress, Why Stress is Good for You and How You Can Get Good at It. Kelly is a health psychologist, lecturer at Stanford University, and leader in the field of science help. She is the international best-selling author of The Willpower Instinct and recipient of numerous awards, including the Walter J. Gores Award, Stanford's highest teaching honor. Kelly graduated from Boston University with undergraduate degrees in psychology and mass communications and received her PhD from Stanford. Forbes named Kelly one of the 20 most inspiring women to follow on Twitter. And her 2013 TED Global Talk has received more than 7 million views. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Dr. Kelly McGonigal.
Sorry, I'm just removing this. Those of you who know me know I'm a very physical speaker. And I have to stand behind the podium tonight, so I want to make sure that I can see you from behind the podium. Okay, so thanks so much for coming out tonight. I want to start with a poll. I would like to ask you how you currently think about and relate to stress in your life. So here are two possible ways of thinking about stress. On one side, you could view stress as harmful. Stress is harmful and something to be avoided. On the other hand, you might view stress as maybe something good. Stress is positive, and it should be embraced and utilized. Let's just take a poll. So maybe you see the truth in both, but let's say one kind of resonates more with you, how you think about stress, how you talk about stress with your friends, your coworkers, your family, and how you relate to the stress in your life. So hands up. How many of you think basically stress is harmful and should be avoided? Mm-hmm. And who thinks that stress is helpful and should be embraced? Wait a minute, some of you voted twice. I caught that. That's good. I think you're already embracing the paradox of stress. Well, 5 years ago, I would have been strongly on one side of this debate. I would have been on the side of people arguing that stress is harmful and should be avoided, reduced, managed, whatever we can do to have less stress in our lives. And that's really for two reasons that I held that view. One, I'm a health psychologist. And the other is I'm a devout pessimist, not likely to see the good in anything that's not obviously good. But I've changed my mind about stress. I have a much more balanced and positive view of stress than I did 5 years ago. And part of my goal tonight, for those of you who, like me, really only saw stress as inherently toxic, the enemy to be avoided, the signal that there's something really screwed up with you in your life when you're feeling it, my hope is to bring you to hold a more balanced view of stress tonight. And I want to start by sharing with you one of the first studies. It's actually came out in 2009, that made me think there was more to stress than the view that we're used to hearing of stress as being always a sign of something wrong and something to be gotten rid of. And this was a study that was conducted originally by the World Gallup Poll. And they went to 121 different countries and asked people in each of these countries, anyone over the age of 15 they could find, did you experience a great deal of stress yesterday? And then they created something called a stress index for each of these nations. And that's the percentage of people in each nation who said yes. Yesterday was very stressful. And a few years after that, some psychologists got their hands on this data, and they decided to ask an interesting question. Is a nation's stress index associated with other indices of well-being? And like most people, they expected that the answer would be yes, they should be related. A higher stress index should be associated with all sorts of negative outcomes. And what they found instead was exactly the opposite, that the higher a nation's stress index, the higher the GDP, the greater the life expectancy of that nation, the more people in that nation who said they were satisfied with their health, their work, their communities, and their lives, and the happier the nation, when you ask people in that country how happy they were. And that was really kind of confounding for these psychologists, because we're so used to thinking of stress as something that we don't want. Why would it be the case that having so many stressed out people would be good for the economy, for public health, and for national happiness? And it turns out that one of the reasons that a high stress index was associated with good outcomes is because stress is associated with some other things that actually we do want in our lives. So the higher a country's stress index, the more likely it was that people in that nation would also say they felt a great deal of joy yesterday, that they laughed and smiled a lot yesterday, that they felt a lot of love yesterday, or that they learned something interesting yesterday. And it seems as though when people say, I'm so stressed out, my life is so stressful, you know, yesterday was so stressful, often what they are saying is that they lead lives that include roles, goals, and relationships that are personally meaningful, and that from those roles and relationships and goals, all those different contexts, they produce both joy and love and laughter and learning, and also a lot of stress. Right? It's not the case that we have good things in our lives that make us happy and fulfilled and help us learn and grow, and then we have the stressful things in our lives that just suck. That doesn't seem to be the case. Instead, stress seems to co-arise with the things that we do want in life. And in fact, when the researchers looked at the individual level, not just the national level, but looked at people who said they were stressed out, and other emotions that they might feel, like depression, sadness, shame, anger, joy, love, they found that the happiest people around the world were the ones who said they were highly stressed, but didn't endorse being depressed. And when they looked at the people who were most unhappy, they found that people who were experiencing the highest levels of shame and anger, the lowest levels of happiness and joy and love, there was a notable lack of stress. Right? These people were not saying they were stressed out. And so whatever it is we mean when we say, I'm stressed out, this is stressful, it's not synonymous with things like depression or shame or anger. That stress is actually much more complex. And this is what I call the stress paradox. That when we're stressed out, we often don't like it. We don't like how it feels. It actually motivates us to find something that we can do to change the way that we feel. And so there's something inherently distressing about stress. But at the same time, that feeling of distress, its presence in our lives, is often a signal that there are also things in our lives that are going to give rise to the joy, to the love, and to the personal growth and the personal meaning. And that, again, they coexist together, that it's very hard to find people who are reporting the things that we want in life, the happiness, the love, the personal growth, who say that their lives aren't stressful. And the stress paradox points to really these two different sides of stress, that even though it's distressing, its role in our life may not necessarily be only harmful or only associated with suffering. And when it comes to the stress paradox, in my experience, in my training as a health psychologist, I was taught to only talk about that one side of stress, that stress could make you sick, that stress can make you unhappy, that stress can destroy your focus or your relationships. And I was never really taught to think about stress as a signal of something good or something meaningful in our lives, and certainly not taught how to use stress so that we can experience more of the connection with others, the sense of meaning and the sense of growth, rather than wasting a lot of energy and time trying to get rid of the stress or fix those feelings instead of engaging with life. And a few years ago, research started to come out suggesting that there might be a way to actually talk about stress and think about stress that makes us better able to actually hold both of those opposites at the same time. That even when we're feeling distressed, we might be able to engage with the stress in our lives in a way that gives us more of the connection, the meaning, and the growth that are sometimes associated with stress. And what you're looking at here, or as you'll hear, are these two stress mindsets that I opened the talk with, asking you how you think about stress. And this comes from research led by Leah Crum, who's now at Stanford, but started this research at Yale University, asking people how they think about stress. And what she found was that how people think about stress seems to have a very big effect on the way that stress influences their health, their happiness, and their productivity at work. That people who view stress as harmful and particularly people who think they should try to avoid stress for that reason, that they are more likely to experience stress-related health problems, they're more likely to be depressed, they're more likely to be overwhelmed by the stress in their lives, and they're more likely to be distracted or unproductive or burnt out in the workplace. And on the other hand, people who held a more positive view of stress, not necessarily seeing stress as always good, like bring it on stress, but who were able to see the good in stress and think about ways to embrace it and use it rather than avoid it or suppress it, they were healthier, they were happier, they were better able to find meaning in the stressful circumstances of their lives, and they were also feeling more productive and more engaged at work. And when I first started seeing some of these findings, the skeptic in me basically came to this conclusion. Well, the reason people who have a positive view of stress are happier and healthier is because they aren't really stressed, right? Suffer a little bit more, and you will join me on the other side of the mindset scale with the, you know, intelligent people who understand stress really is bad for you. And sort of long story short, I'll spare you some of the data analysis, but that doesn't seem to be the case. It's not the case that the only people who hold a positive view of stress are those who've not suffered. In fact, the opposite is often true. People who face the most adversity are often the most able to actually see the benefits in their stress and in their suffering. And it's also not the case that seeing the good in stress is only helpful if you're just a little bit stressed, like it's, you know, good stress. But bad stress, no, this mindset wouldn't help at all. That doesn't seem to be the case. And when I started to look more at why this mindset might actually change the effect of experiencing stress on health and happiness and productivity, a couple of things popped out of the data in the literature. So when people view stress as harmful, the meaning of stress changes for them. People who view stress as harmful and something to be avoided actually view their own stress, whether it's their heart pounding or the anxiety that keeps them up at night, they view that stress as a signal that they are inadequate to the challenges of their lives. You know, if I'm a parent and I experience stress around parenting, there must be something wrong with me as a mother or something wrong with my kids, but there's something wrong here. If I am at work and I experience stress in my job, I'm going to interpret that as meaning I'm not good at my job, I need to find a different job, there's something wrong with my workplace, because I should be able to have this job and not experience stress. If I'm trying to make a change in my life, or if I'm trying to improve a relationship that really has a lot of conflict and pain in it, and I find that stressful, I'm going to take that as a signal that I'm not up for this, and maybe I should give up on that goal. And again, among people who view stress as just pure toxicity, when they feel stressed, the first appraisal that arises is often, I can't handle this. There's something wrong with me or there's something wrong with my life. Another thing that seems to happen for people who are firmly entrenched in the view that stress is harmful rather than helpful is that they feel more alone in their stress. If you ask them, you know, how stressed out do you think your coworkers are or other parents are or other people are in their families and relationships, they think they are more stressed out than other people are. They find it very difficult to actually understand the common humanity of stress, that actually most people are carrying enormous burdens that aren't visible, but are utterly human and part of life. And on the other hand, people who view stress as inevitable and something that can be utilized, could be a catalyst for connection or growth, they feel less alone in their stress and their suffering, and they are actually better at recruiting the social support that they need and building communities of support. And again, that belief that stress is either harmful and toxic or inevitable and just a sign of that I care about something, like part of life, right? Those two mindsets lead to different ways of how we think and feel about our own stressful circumstances and how able we are to actually recruit the support we need and build supportive communities. And the last thing that really jumped out about how stress mindset influences how we experience stress is that people who view stress as toxic and something to be avoided are more likely to rely on what psychologists call avoidant coping strategies. That means when they feel stressed, they think the biggest problem is their feelings of stress, because we've been told stress is a toxic state. And so I need to escape this toxic state. So when I'm stressed, instead of rising to the challenge, instead of talking to someone about it, instead of thinking about what I might be able to change in my life, or thinking about the situation in a way that would make me feel better about it. Instead of engaging, I look for ways to escape. I might get drunk, or I might binge watch TV on Netflix, or I might shift into denial, or I might be unable to get out of bed because I just can't cope with the distress that I'm feeling. And in contrast, people who view stress as an inevitable part of a meaningful life, something that needs to be engaged rather than suppressed, they're much less likely to rely on these kind of coping strategies. And it actually turns out that that belief that stress is inevitable and something that can be worked with rather than fundamentally unworkable, that belief leads people to be more willing to take difficult actions that might actually address the source of their stress. It makes them better able to change the way they're thinking about the situation. They're willing to grapple with it in a way that gives them more hope or gives them a better way to deal with the situation. And again, as I said, they're also more likely to recruit social support or engage their communities. And when I saw this sort of thing emerging from the data about how the way that you think about stress changes the way you relate to stress in your life, I couldn't help but think about everything that we know from the last, you know, 5 decades or so of stress research about when stress is most likely to actually be toxic. And that is when you have a certain relationship to the stress in your life, where the stress feels against your will, out of your control, isolating from others, and fundamentally without meaning. Right? And when people feel that way about the stress in their lives, and they feel inadequate to the stressful circumstances of their lives, that's the kind of stress that predicts all the things we think of as being stress-related. That's the kind of stress that predicts depression, addiction, heart disease, early mortality, all the things that we don't want. It's like in that World Gallup poll I told you that people who were really stressed and not depressed were the most thriving. And the people who are doing the worst are the ones who really have had a collapse of the stress response system, where they no longer feel able to engage. And it's that relationship that really seems to be the thing that we want to work with, rather than, I think, this idea that we've all had for so long that the stress itself is the problem, and that our energy and attention should be focused on trying to reduce or suppress or escape that state of stress. And one of the things that I write about in the book is what we know about what makes someone good at stress. So I just described what makes stress really harmful, when we have that particular feeling of inadequacy to our lives and being totally alone in our stress. And when it comes to what makes someone good at stress, there's actually a lot of research on this. And in my book, I write about a lot of different communities where people seem to be thriving despite being in very seriously stressful circumstances, whether it's executives who are going through major transitions in their industry and in their workplace, children who are growing up in areas that are high levels of poverty and crime, all the way to looking at former child soldiers and communities that are dealing with war and corruption and AIDS, places like Rwanda and Sierra Leone. And of all the research that has gone to places like this, places that are full of chaos, suffering, conflict, uncertainty, it seems like a few themes really emerge about what makes certain people and certain communities able to thrive and at some point transform that stress, adversity, or suffering into something positive. And there are really 3 things that describe the people or the communities who are good at stress, who don't experience that collapse in the face of stress. And the first is that they find ways to engage with meaningful choices or actions, even if they can't control the source of their stress. They look for things that they can do, that they can say yes to, or choices they can make that continue to move them in a direction of hope and action, rather than looking for ways to disengage from their lives, from their relationships, or from the challenges. The second is they use that stress or that adversity as a catalyst for strengthening relationships and building communities of support, instead of isolating themselves or entering a sort of inner narrative that says, I'm the only one dealing with this, and I'm alone in this. And the third thing that really describes these communities and these individuals is that they have a growth mindset towards adversity and stress. that they believe it's possible that no matter how difficult this is right now, no matter how overwhelmed I am, or no matter how much I would never have chosen this circumstance for myself, they think that it's possible that at a future point in time, this experience will have strengthened them in some meaningful way. They're able to look back at past adversity and see ways that they have been strengthened and actually appreciate some of those benefits and appreciate their own strengths and actually view whether it's stress they're going through now or something that's happened in the past really as an opportunity to learn and grow. And when I looked at this research, I couldn't help but be struck by the fact that these three things, engaging with challenges, connecting with others, and learning and growing from experience, these three coping strategies are fundamentally built into our stress response, our biological stress response. And the very thing that we have considered to be simply toxic, our pounding heart, our flood of stress hormones, the way that our minds get stuck in trying to figure things out, all those experiences that we have viewed as toxic are actually ways that our brains and our bodies are trying to help us do these things, rise to the challenge, find the energy to act, find a way to connect with others and strengthen relationships and communities, and actually figure out a way to make meaning out of the circumstance, to learn something or to grow in some way. And so when I talk about finding the upside of stress, I want to be very clear about what I'm talking about. I'm not talking about going out and trying to create more suffering for yourself or others. Right? And it's also not about trying to deny the fact that stressful circumstances are distressing, that they come with some level of pain, discomfort, and suffering. But the upside of stress is in part the fact that actually we as human beings have biological, psychological, and social capacities for transforming those stressful circumstances into positive action, into connection and compassion, and into learning and growth and meaning, and that they're actually built into the very thing that we most fear, which is our physiological experience of stress. And so finding the upside of stress isn't so much about trying to find a way to convince yourself that you're glad your boss is a jerk or that you lost your job or whatever the stressful situation is. It's not about trying to spin the positive lining on that. It's really more about finding a way to trust yourself in stressful circumstances and turn what we thought of as an enemy, our own pounding hearts and our own racing minds and thoughts, to turn that into a resource, because that's really what it is. And we wouldn't have a stress response if it wasn't there to help us engage with the challenges in our lives. So what I'm going to do now, the second half of the talk, is actually give you a little bit of a mini mindset intervention. Because the other thing I talk about in the book is this emerging science that shows if you choose to see the upside in your own physical stress response or in stressful circumstances, it actually transforms your stress response in a way that makes you better at stress. And so I'm going to give you a couple of those interventions yourself, some ways of thinking about your stress response differently, and then show you a little bit about what might happen if you were to adopt that mindset as sort of a default way of relating to stress in your life. Here's the first upside of stress. So this type of mindset intervention was first developed by Jeremy Jameson at Harvard University. He's now at the University of Rochester. And he was an athlete who was very interested by the fact that athletes understand that their stress response gives them energy. And often before a game, they're not trying to calm down. You know, they're not like, meditate, release the anxiety. They're like, how do I amp up more? Because they view their adrenaline as a resource. And Jameson knew from the psychological literature that adrenaline helps you rise to many challenges, not just ones that require physical strength, that they help people do better on mental challenges, on exams, in negotiations, in the business world, that in many situations where you need to perform under pressure, your stress response actually makes you perform better, even when it feels like anxiety. And so he was interested in what would happen if he told people who were anxious to actually think about their physical stress response as a resource. And he simply told them, you know, your pounding heart, when your skin starts sweating, maybe you breathe a little bit faster. These are all signs that your body is giving you energy, getting more blood, more oxygen, more glucose to your brain and to your muscles so that you will be better equipped to rise to the challenge. And if you feel anxious before you have to do something important or difficult, you should just remember, okay, your stress response is giving you energy, and it might actually help you do better. That was the mindset intervention, all completely true, by the way. And he and colleagues and now other independent research groups have looked at delivering this mindset intervention, just a minute's worth or so, in settings that range from students who are about to take a very stressful exam to people who are about to give a public presentation. And what they found is that people who view their own anxiety and stress response as energy actually end up, well, they end up performing better, by the way. They score better on exams, they give better talks, they're more inspiring to others. But what's really interesting is they actually have a different stress response. And they have what stress researchers call a challenge response. And one of the biggest misconceptions about stress is that every stress response you have is fight or flight, which is sort of an emergency survival mode that your body can go into when you feel very threatened. A challenge response is different from a fight or flight response in that it actually gives you more access to energy, to physical energy and mental energy. So when you feel threatened in a stressful situation, one of the things that happens is your blood vessels constrict. Your heart's pounding, but your blood vessels constrict because your brain at some level is thinking, this is a dangerous situation. Even if it's just an exam or a difficult conversation you're about to have, that survival mode, your body and brain are thinking, there might be some blood loss involved in this conflict. And so your blood vessels constrict to actually avoid dying from blood loss. It's an old evolutionary thing. And that's one way you can have a stress response. And this is also associated with high levels of inflammation. If you were going to say that there is a stress state that is toxic chronically, it would be that stress state, a threat state. But what the researchers have found is that people who choose to view their own anxiety, their own overwhelm, their own physical sensations of stress as energy that could be helpful, rather than a sign that they're going to choke or that they need to calm down, they have a different response, a challenge response. And one of the ways that it differs is that the blood vessels stay more relaxed so that you actually get more energy to your muscles and to your brain. Another way that it differs is that you have lower levels of inflammation throughout your body, which again is one of the things that can make chronic stress unhealthy. So you're having more access to your energy, which means your brain and your body's going to work better. You have lower levels of inflammation, which might increase your risk of stress-related diseases or other problems. And the changes that you do have in a challenge response actually help you perform better. And this is all without making people less stressed. So in these studies, one of the really interesting things they found is that people who embrace their stress actually end up having higher levels of adrenaline. It's a good stress response. They're not calmer. They're stressed, but they're stressed in a healthier way, one that helps them do better under pressure and one that is healthier for them in the long term. So this is one way to think about finding the upside of stress. When you're in a situation where you notice your heart pounding or you're sweating, you're feeling anxious, you're feeling overwhelmed, to just view it as energy and to trust that actually you can do something with that energy and to trust that stress can actually help you rise to the challenge. And if you take this view of stress, it turns out that this view can actually protect people from burnout in highly stressful situations. So this was a study that was conducted at Jacobs University in Germany, where they actually followed mid-career professionals in two stressful professions that have high levels of burnout, teaching and medicine. And in both of these groups, at the beginning of the study, they asked them, how much anxiety and pressure do they feel about work? And how do they think about that anxiety, right? Do they view it as energy? Do they view it as a source of motivation and important information about sort of what they need to do and how to do it? Or do they view it as debilitating? And what they found is that as they follow these mid-career professionals over time, the ones who started the study viewing stress as energy, as information, as motivation, were much less likely to experience emotional exhaustion and burnout as they went on in their careers compared to people who viewed anxiety as just harmful and debilitating. And what was interesting is the protective effect was strongest for the people who had the most anxiety and pressure at work. It was not the case that sort of viewing anxiety as helpful is good as long as you're just a little bit anxious and your work is just a little bit stressful. It was the opposite, that actually this mindset is most protective actually for people who suffer from anxiety disorders and people who suffer from very high levels of pressure and demands in the workplace. And I think that's actually a really important point about all of the research on stress mindsets, that sort of the situations where we're most likely to think, well, this is the kind of stress you shouldn't embrace because this is really the bad stress. It's often in those circumstances where trying to see the upside in stress and trusting yourself to handle it is actually most protective. Oh. And for those in the audience, there were words and images that were meant to accompany that. Okay. So here's your second mindset intervention. Now, most of you probably already knew that stress can give you energy through adrenaline, but there's a lot of other things going on in your stress response system that can happen when you're under stress. And one of them is that your pituitary gland can release a hormone called oxytocin. And oxytocin, of all the hormones in the human body and brain, probably has the best reputation, right? There's practically a PR campaign for oxytocin. You can buy inhalants online to snort oxytocin. And the reason that oxytocin has such a good reputation is because it's associated with feeling loving, feeling connected, and feeling caring. A study just came out a couple weeks ago that when you stare into the eyes of your dog and your dog stares back, you release oxytocin, your dog releases oxytocin, and those warm feelings you get, that's part of oxytocin. But oxytocin is more than the sort of loving kind of bonding hormone. Oxytocin fine-tunes the social instincts of your brain, and it does that in two ways. It gives you more social intelligence. So when you have higher levels of oxytocin, you can actually read people's facial expressions better to understand what they're feeling and thinking. You're better able to attune with your environment and act in a way that is cooperative. And you also get more of a warm glow from helping others. It actually motivates you to connect with people that you already care about and trust, right? So it's making you, in a sense, pro-social. And it really can strengthen relationships in that way. But the other thing that oxytocin does is it dampens the fear system of the brain. And when oxytocin levels elevate, it actually makes you brave. It makes you willing to take risks. It actually increases what psychologists call the approach motivation system of the brain, while dampening down the inhibition or the fear system of the brain. And so this is part of your stress response system. And at the same time that you're releasing adrenaline to help you rise to the challenge and act with energy, you're also releasing this hormone that is trying to motivate you to connect with others, to use your social resources, and also gives you a willingness to take actions that are difficult or uncomfortable, whether for yourself or to protect others or defend others or connect with others. And in that way, you've got this stress hormone that actually makes you feel connected and caring and at the same time courageous. And that's a good part of the stress response system. And it's sometimes referred to as the tend and befriend system. And I wanted to share with you a study that shows what happens when you choose to actually have a tend and befriend response to stress rather than allowing some of the competing instincts to kind of derail you from that type of stress response. So we know that, you know, sometimes we feel the desire to connect with others when we're stressed out, but sometimes we feel a competing instinct to withdraw or to try to escape our own feelings of stress. And this was a study that was done at UCLA where they actually brought people into the laboratory, and once they arrived, they said, "This is a study of pain. You're going to be receiving painful electric shocks." And worse than that, you actually were told to bring a loved one into your study, into the study with you. So you get a painful shock, and then your loved one is going to get a painful shock. And the researchers gave the people in the study two different coping strategies to alternate. One coping strategy was to squeeze a stress ball. And the idea there was, okay, you're feeling stressed out about this. This is painful. This is not a good situation. Well, squeeze the stress ball. It'll help you reduce your stress. It'll help you relieve your stress. That's sort of escapist way of relating to stress. And then during other painful shocks, participants were encouraged to hold the hand of their loved ones and think about sending their loved ones support, right? Attend and befriend response. And then the researchers looked at what happened in participants' brains when they were doing these two different coping strategies. And what they noticed is that when people were choosing to use their own stress as a catalyst for connection, and they chose to think about supporting their loved one in this painful and stressful situation, it increased activation of the reward system of the brain, the system of the brain that gives us hope and that motivates us to really stay present and engaged. And at the same time, it decreased activation in the fear systems of the brain, which is exactly what you would expect if someone is having a tend and befriend stress response. And in contrast, squeezing the stress ball didn't do either one of those things. Squeezing the stress ball is an ineffective coping strategy compared to choosing to use your own stress and pain as a motivator to connect with others and to offer support. And it turns out that when we choose that way of responding to our own stressful experiences, that it helps us cope with very difficult experiences, no matter what. And I'm going to give you a data dump now, just to give you a sense of what it means when we choose to use our own stress as a catalyst for connection with others. So after a tragedy, people who find a way to volunteer are more optimistic, energized, less anxious, angry, and overwhelmed by the tragedy that they just went through. People who survive a natural disaster are less likely to develop PTSD if they helped others in the immediate aftermath. Among people with chronic pain, becoming a peer counselor relieves their pain, improves their physical disability and depression, and increases their sense of purpose. After the loss of a spouse, being able to take care of someone reduces depression and helps with the grieving process. People who've survived a terrorist attack feel less survivor guilt and more meaning in life when they find a way to help others. And after a heart attack, people who volunteer experience more hope, less depression, and a greater sense of purpose. And so this is another way that we can choose to view the upside of stress. These two very different aspects of stress, right? That stress can give us energy to help us engage, but also that our own stress response is trying to motivate us to connect with others. And if we choose that type of stress response, if we listen to what our body and brain is telling us and giving us the physical impulse to do, it actually makes us more resilient in the face of whatever stress we're going through. And so the last way that we can embrace stress, I'm running short on time, so I'm going to give you the shorthand for this, but you should also know that part of your own stress response is you release chemicals that actually help you learn from the experience, like DHEA, which helps balance your autonomic nervous system immediately after a stressful experience, but also that works as a neurosteroid. And when you release DHEA from your adrenal glands after a stressful experience, it's making your brain more plastic. It's helping your brain rewire itself in a way so that you're able to understand what you went through, you're able to learn from it, so you'll be better at meeting that kind of stress in the future. And ultimately, it makes the brain more resilient. Psychologists call this stress inoculation, that going through something difficult is like getting a vaccine for your brain so that you'll be better at stress the next time you experience it. And again, this is built into this state that we're so used to fearing as toxic. And it turns out that when we choose to view stress as an opportunity to learn and grow, you actually release more DHEA during and after a stressful experience. The expectation that stress is an opportunity to learn and grow changes the biochemistry of your stress response in a way that makes you more likely to experience resilience as a result of whatever you just went through. So, sort of as a final thought for what it would mean to see the upside in stress so that you can get good at stress, it really comes down to, in moments of stress, trying to view your stress response as a resource rather than a sign that there's something fundamentally wrong with you or something fundamentally wrong with your life that makes the situation unworkable. And even in situations where you can't control sort of how stressed out you are and you haven't chosen the stress in your life, you can still view yourself as a resource, view your body as a resource, your brain as a resource, and understand that it's possible to respond to stress in a way that makes the benefits of stress more likely so that we come out of the other side with stronger relationships, a sense of meaning in our lives, a sense of growth, or at least being able to act in ways that we endorse, and less likely that we experience some of the harmful effects of stress that we've come to fear so much. So thank you for contemplating a different way of thinking about stress. I think now we're going to continue the conversation.
Thank you, Kelly. That was, are we on? We're good?
Give us just
I don't think we're on yet. Test. Test. There we go. Okay. Thank you, Kelly. That was very insightful. I really appreciate your words. The advice and message in your books makes great sense for adults and how adults think about their lives, but I'm wondering what your thoughts are about young people. The mom in me really worries that adults in our community, teachers and coaches, will misuse your message, perhaps, to apply more stress and pressure to youth. And how can stress possibly be good for kids, or what are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, so I have a lot of thoughts about this, and you'll have to forgive me because I'm going to answer this like five different ways because this is a really important issue. And, you know, I have nightmares about the way that the science can be misconstrued or how the book might be misinterpreted, particularly by people who haven't read it. So one of the things that I want to start with is even just a definition of stress, which I haven't given yet. So stress is something that arises when something that we care about is at stake and we feel like there might be something we can do about it. So when you look at depression, for example, that's like a complete collapse of the stress response system. You might realize that there's a lot of things going on that you don't want, but the part of you that can respond in a meaningful way, sort of it just collapses because you don't think there's anything that you can do or there's no one who cares. So if we think about whether or not we even want our kids to experience stress, I think it's actually a mistake to think that what we want is a less stressed child. And even if we try not to put pressure on kids, if there is anything they care about, friends, relationships, school, how you relate to them as a parent, if they care, they will experience stress. And there's nothing that you can do to prevent that from happening. So I just sort of like put that out there. Like the ideal is not to have unstressed kids. And when you look at the research on sort of when stress is helpful or harmful in children, you know, there's been some really great research sort of defining good stress, complicated stress, which is both helpful and potentially harmful, and toxic stress in children and in adolescents. And the type of stress that almost always has positive effects, it makes kids more resilient, it helps them learn and grow, it helps them find meaning. That's the sort of things like, you know, going out for sports teams, good academic challenges, new experiences, having to do things on their own that they feel a little bit uncomfortable about. So that, even though kids are often distressed while it's happening, the long-term consequences are almost always good. In the complex stress column, those are things that are best described as adversity, like parents getting divorced, being sort of having temporary financial problems at home, having social problems that are a little isolated, like losing a best friend or moving or something like that. And those often have the potential to trigger things we would be really concerned about, you know, like signs of depression or anxiety, but often in the long term actually give rise to greater resilience and growth. So those are kids who need to be cared for, and what seems to be most important is to have caring relationships with adults. And kids who go through that type of adversity and have really caring relationships with adults almost always see more positive outcomes in the long term. And later on in life, they are more satisfied with their lives, they're better able to find meaning, they're healthier. And then the really toxic stress, the kind of stress that everyone would want to protect kids from, it's the stress that's characterized by chronic and pervasive maltreatment by adults in their lives, abuse, neglect, social bullying that's persistent and not buffered by at least one meaningful friendship, or severe poverty, lack of resources. That's the type of stress that really seems to be toxic. And it's also least likely to be the kind of stress that caring parents are inflicting on their kids or caring teachers are inflicting on their kids, or that anyone is really able to control except through, you know, social movements, right? That reducing poverty is a great thing to do. And so I think it's actually helpful to think about those different levels of stress, because a lot of the initiatives to reduce stress are actually not about addressing the things that are most likely to be toxic about stress. When kids are in situations where they don't have caring relationships with adults, they don't have caring relationships with peers, and they feel enormous pressure, or they're in dealing with adversity that feels divorced from meaning. And a lot of the things that are really protective for kids are what we would call stressful, being involved in things that are challenging and difficult, new experiences, normal, typical friction in social relationships. And so I think that that even just having that mindset that protecting kids from stress, if you are a caring parent, like you've already protected them from the one type of stress that's most likely to be toxic. And the other thing that I think about is sort of how this mindset research has been used in schools right now. So actually, this, some of the research that I described is being used in schools with kids, with at-risk kids. And in my book, I write about a lot of these programs because I'm an educator. I'm very passionate about education. And some of the programs that I write about in the book are working with kids who live in poverty, high levels of crime, they're in foster care, and who experience stereotype threat, and they may be a minority in a school. And they go into these mindset interventions, they go into schools and they give very simple messages like, when you're feeling anxious before a test, I know you've been told you need to calm down because it's a sign that you're going to blow it. That anxiety could be a sign that you're getting ready to meet this challenge. Don't worry about it. And what that does is it signals to these kids that actually they can handle the stress in their lives. And what a lot of sort of stress reduction messages send to kids is that when you're feeling stressed out, it means you can't handle this. And kids and teens have learned, and adults too, have learned to view their own stress as a signal of their own weakness. And so a lot of the interventions that I think are really interesting are the ones that go in and try to change the meaning of stress for kids that actually allows them to engage with stress in a more helpful way. And I think if I were to think about what sort of interventions, teachers and parents should be interested in, it's that kind of communication. Mm-hmm. Right? How do you talk to your kids when they're feeling anxious so that they don't come to assume that that anxiety means that they're inadequate? How do you talk to kids about recognizing stress as a sign that they care about something and thinking about what they want to do? Stressed out about a relationship? Do you want to apologize? Do you want to connect? You know, why is this meaningful to you? And the other intervention, by the way, that seems to be very effective with kids and teens and college students is the message that they aren't alone in their stress. And it's funny, I recently read an article about some of the recent suicides here in Palo Alto. And one of the students said that one of the biggest sources of the misery that the kids were going through, in her opinion, was that they felt really isolated in their stress. And that even though sometimes people said things like, oh, you're not the only one with problems, that nobody really believes it. That people just don't talk about it. And there are a lot of interventions now that I think are consistent with this approach to embracing stress that really normalize stress and say, especially when you're feeling alone in your stress, that's the time to connect. That's the time to look for other people who are stressed out and right. ways that you can help them. And so I think if you're thinking about applying this stuff to kids, it's that sort of thing and not the sort of idiot message of like, stress is good, suck it up,
you're right.
which is not helpful. The message.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. All right. I was reading the book and sharing it with my family at the dinner table, and I was telling her some of the messages and some of the research, and my 14-year-old daughter was skeptical, and she said, well, this sounds like something that, you know, Steve Jobs believed around eating carrots will cure his cancer or something. And, you know, so what is that balance between mindset and, you know, the power of the mind and the power of science? And, you know, what is that connection? Because I think there's a lot of, you know, misideas around
mind over body.
Mind over body.
Yes. Yes, definitely. So this book is largely about mindset science. And just to give like a little bit of background, what a mindset is a belief that influences the way you think about things, the emotions that you have in response to different experiences, and how you act and how you cope. And not every belief seems to actually have the power of a mindset that can change your biology, it changes your psychology, and it changes your actual behavior. So it's not that every belief can radically transform what you experience and how you are in the world, but some beliefs do. And when it comes to sort of why our beliefs about stress are so important, I think the best way to think about it is to understand that from the science of stress, stress has pretty much always been defined in contemporary psychology as being the appraisal that you have, it's based on an appraisal that you have about a situation and your resources to handle it. And the type of stress response you have is a combination of the two. So you think about the situation you're in, how hard is it, how bad is this, how difficult, uncomfortable, unwanted is this? And then there's a second appraisal that kicks in. Do I have the resources to handle this? Do I have faith, a community that supports me? Do I have skills? Do I have knowledge? Do I have courage? Do I have a sense of humor? What are my resources for handling this? And those two instinctive appraisals, they come together and they produce a state of stress. And there are all these different flavors of stress responses you can have, like fight or flight and threat, a challenge response, a tend and befriend response, a growth response, that are based in those appraisals. And we've always known from the science of stress that stress is based in appraisals. It's not objective. Nobody can stress you out without some sort of appraisal going on. And because stress is rooted in how we think about ourselves and how we think about the situation, that's why how we think about stress changes the way that stress affects us biologically and emotionally, and it affects our behaviors because it's primarily rooted in appraisals of things like, can I handle this? And is there, you know, how bad is the situation? And a lot of the mindset interventions that change the biology of people's stress response, in some of those studies, they directly look at what explains it. And a big thing that explains it is when you choose to view stress as energy, or you choose to view stress as an opportunity to learn and grow, or you think about your friends and family supporting you, you're actually increasing your sense of your ability to handle the situation. And that profoundly changes the biology of your stress response in a way that changes everything down the cascade, how you feel, how you relate to others, how you handle the challenge. And in contrast to something like cancer, I mean, well, I already started this talk by telling you I'm a pessimist. So one of the things I'm deeply pessimistic and skeptical about is that, like, you could visualize your way out of cancer. There are some things that do not seem to be profoundly influenced by how you think about it, and cancer is one of them. You can't think yourself cancer. You can't heal yourself by thinking differently about cancer. And I would hate for the sort of the science to get confused about what exactly we can manifest for ourselves by thinking about it. The reason stress is so influenced by mindset is because stress is a psychological experience that is rooted in appraisals.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Great. Have there been any mindset exercises or workshops that work in the corporate environment?
Mm-hmm. Yes. I'll tell you about one.
Cool.
The very first stress mindset intervention that was sort of named as such that I know of, I think it was the first ever, was led by Aaliyah Crum, who I mentioned started out at Yale. And she was interested. She'd done all this work showing that how you think about stress can influence health and happiness, but it was all correlational. And so she, you know, if you really want to know just how you think about stress matter, you have to take people who are stressed out and who view stress as harmful and try to change their minds about stress. So she was beginning this research right in the middle of the economic collapse of 2008. And she thought, who might be really stressed out about this? So where did she go? She went to the finance world. She went to UBS, the bank. And they had human resources send out an email like, hey, is anyone stressed out? Sign up for our stress management training. And in the very first one, people got randomized to either a wait list, so nothing, or a kind of typical stress reduction online intervention that basically sent people these short videos that said things like, stress is the leading cause of everything bad you've never wanted to experience. You need to learn how to reduce your stress. So like typical scare stress, the kind of thing I was doing 10 years ago. And I apologize. Some of you in this room, I think, might actually have been in some of those stress reduction workshops. Sorry. this is my apology tour.
That's fine. So
the other intervention in this study, they watched a series of short videos that said, you know, basically, well, everyone knows that stress can be harmful, but the latest science says stress can also be enhancing. Stress can give you energy. Stress can help you rise to a challenge. Many people develop their strengths by going through stressful circumstances. A lot of the same sort of upsides that I was sharing with you. So they just watched these videos. That was the whole intervention. And they followed up with them weeks later to sort of see how they were thinking about stress and how they were dealing with stress in a time of enormous, you know, workplace stress. And in that first study, what they found is that, first of all, there was no benefit to the stress reduction intervention, sort of the normal one. And they just became more convinced that their stress was toxic. The group that had seen the videos that said, well, you know, there is an upside to stress, and here's what it is, they ended up coming to a slightly more positive view of stress, one that was really, I think, balanced. And I think, by the way, when I talk about seeing the upside of stress, it's about balancing our mindset. It's not about denying the harm. It's about also being able to see the good. So in this study, they had this more balanced view of stress, and they were happier, they were healthier, they were experiencing less stress-related symptoms like headaches and back pain. They were feeling more engaged at work. They felt better about their collaborations with their colleagues. They felt like they were contributing more in the workplace, so sort of less of that burnout or disengagement. And in follow-up studies that she did in other workplaces, they actually started to do different types of mindset interventions where they actually, like, now they were straight up telling people that they were trying to change their minds about stress. So the first study was kind of like sneaky, like, we're just going to tell you stress is good and see what happens. And in her later interventions in the workplace, it was, hey, guess what? How you think about stress matters. And there are some good things about stress and some bad things about stress. But if you choose to embrace stress rather than avoid or view stress as really the enemy, you can actually handle stress better, and invited people to choose to see the upside in stress, much more like the conversation we've had tonight. And in those studies, you see even better benefits in long-term in terms of health and happiness and productivity. And in those studies, there's actually a correlation between the degree of mindset change and the increase in some of these psychological and workplace outcomes. That is, people who came to a more positive view, the more their mindset changed, the more they were experiencing these benefits. And there have been some other studies like that, but that's my answer to that question.
All right. One of my favorite stories from the book was the research about the housekeepers.
Yes.
Can you tell? I just think that stories are such a powerful way, and it's sort of a corporate environment. It's a work environment. So can you tell the story about the housekeepers?
So that was a study that Aaliyah Crum did that was before she started looking at stress mindset. She was interested in general if how you think about something that could be aversive or difficult, if you can change its effects on your physical health by thinking about it differently. And this was a study that got a lot of press attention when it came out. She went into hotels where housekeepers were viewing their work as just sort of hard on their bodies, just the physical strain of the labor. And when she asked them if they felt like they were exercisers, like, none of them viewed their work as exercise. They actually thought they were sedentary. None of them viewed their physical labor as meeting any of the standards for physical activity that are good for your health. So she created these great posters in Spanish and in English and was posting them in break rooms and hotels, and then gave an actual like 15-minute intervention workshop telling some of them that your work is actually exercise, and you should expect to see the physical benefits of activity. You know that you're supposed to exercise, and you've heard that it's good for your health, it'll help you, you know, maintain a healthy weight and all these other things. And she just said, what you do is exercise. When you lift mattresses and you vacuum, you burn 60 calories an hour. It's more than that. I don't remember what it is. 300. I don't count calories, so I don't know. So you're burning a lot of calories. And then she went away and came back a little bit later to look at whether that mindset intervention had any effect on housekeepers' health. And they looked at a bunch of different biological outcomes. They were looking at BMI, body mass index. They were looking at profiles of cardiovascular health and metabolic health. And what they found is that the housekeepers who had been told to view their work as exercise, they ended up losing weight, losing body fat percentage. They had healthier cardiovascular and metabolic profiles, even though they did not report like going out and joining a gym. And there's been a lot of controversy about, like, okay, how did that happen? Crum's interpretation is pretty straight up. It was a mindset effect. I don't know if that's actually the case, but that was at one of the early studies that made her want to think about what else people might experience in their life as harmful or bad for their bodies that might be actually something that could be helpful. And that's sort of how she landed on stress, because, you know, like physical labor, we know what's bad about it, but there is also a positive side. And that's the origin story of, I think, her stress mindset research.
Yeah, very cool. How does meditation play a role in your theory, since meditation is supposed to calm us down? Are we doing something wrong? Or is it? Dun, dun, dun. Are we doing something wrong by meditating and trying to get rid of those feelings?
Well, if you're meditating to get rid of your feelings, you're definitely doing it wrong. So I don't know if you know, I'm a meditation researcher and a meditation teacher. I don't know if the person who asked that question knows that. That's my work at the Stanford Center for Compassion and Altruism. I spent the last few years designing meditation interventions and studying them. And I think one of the great confusions about meditation in our culture, particularly by people who don't actually do it, is that meditation is an escape from the reality of your life. If you actually sit down and sit still and sit with your mind, what you notice is that all sorts of things come up: physical discomfort, difficult memories you didn't want to think about, strong emotions. And the meditation techniques that I teach related to mindfulness, self-compassion, and compassion for others are about learning to accept all those difficult inner experiences without having to suppress them, push them away, and really change the way that you relate to them so that they're less toxic. And in fact, one of my favorite meditations that I teach and study is called Tonglen, which is a meditation where you actually imagine breathing in suffering, not breathing it out, breathing it in, transforming it in your heart, and breathing out courage, compassion, hope, strength, faith, whatever you want to offer yourself or the world. And when I think about, you know, how I think about this book and about choosing to see the upside in stress, for me, it's a one big Tonglen mindset that, you know, sort of it's the practice of saying, well, the suffering is here, the stress is here, the pain is real. And as much as I might wish I had a life that was free of it, or as much as I wish I could get rid of all the suffering in the world, instead, the reality is it's here, and I'm going to choose the way that I relate to it by accepting it, by leaning into it rather than avoiding it or trying to, you know, drink my way into dissociation from it. And then I'm going to choose to trust that I have the capacity to have courage, to take action, to use it as a catalyst for connection, to rely on my resources and the resources of my community. And that's the mindset of embracing stress. And so if you've been doing other kinds of meditations that, you know, that are about trying to escape from the reality of life, that's a different thing. But I really think of meditation as a training ground for practicing that kind of acceptance and courage that we need to deal with real life.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. There's still some confusion or looking for clarification around the differences between stress and anxiety.
Yeah.
Can you say more about that?
Yeah. So one way that anxiety is sometimes defined is as anticipatory stress. That, you know, physically it is a stress response and it captures your attention in the way that stress will, but it typically is directed at something that hasn't happened yet. So it's a kind of stress response that is actually trying to get your attention and trying to give you physical and mental resources to deal with something that you anticipate being challenging or threatening. So in that way, it actually can be helpful. And of course, you know, I'm speaking as someone who has lots of anxiety, my whole life. So in some ways it's helpful, but of course, sometimes it's also incredibly distracting and distressing. And one of the things that I was most struck by in the research on these mindset interventions is, again and again, when people were doing them with groups of people who had a little bit of anxiety and moderate amount of anxiety and so much anxiety it could be classified as an anxiety disorder, that the idea of accepting and embracing anxiety was most helpful, or at least as helpful, for the people on the anxiety disorder side. And the thing that seems to be sort of like the reason why that would be is because anxiety only becomes really debilitating when people choose a certain relationship to their anxiety that says, this anxiety is so distressing that I'm going to do anything I can to avoid feeling it. So I am going to avoid situations that trigger anxiety, or I'm not going to think about things that make me anxious. I'm not going to have conversations that provoke anxiety. And people start falling into this avoidance anxiety cycle that ends up creating more problems while also restricting their lives and the meaning of their lives. And so these mindset interventions that tell people, no matter how bad your anxiety is, it is giving you energy. It is your brain and body trying to help you. And it's not a sign that you're going to die, and it, like in this moment, and it's not a sign that you are inadequate to whatever it is that's making you anxious. That intervention completely changes the way people relate to their anxiety. And, you know, I do that all the time. When I'm, one of the things that makes me most anxious is flying, which I now have to do several times a week. And I had spent many years with my flying phobia listening to, back in the day, Walkmans with cassettes. That's how long the phobia is, old the phobia is. Listening to these, like, cassettes where people are telling me, calm, you know, serenity. And I'm like, I should be calm on this plane. My heart should not be pounding. And what I do now when I feel anxiety on a plane is I put on my turbulence playlist, which is high energy, like anthems, jock jams, electronic dance music, including the song, We Hit Turbulence. Do you know that song?
Yes.
It's a great, yeah, it's great song during great, turbulence. Great song. And that's me, that's like a version of embracing anxiety. This is not a problem that my heart is pounding right now. I'm going to embrace it like I'm on the dance floor. And it's like, as ridiculous as that sounds, all of these mindset interventions that work with anxiety, there's a version of that that is really about acceptance, that you stop using anxiety as a signal that you can't handle life. And that's transformative, even if the anxiety is not always fun.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. McGonigal, for all of your words of wisdom. I hope that everyone has enjoyed this evening's program brought to you by the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley. Again, we'd like to thank Kelly McGonigal, author of The Upside of Stress, Why Stress is Good and How to Get Good at It, our audience here in Palo Alto, and those of you joining us on the radio. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club is adjourned.
Thank you.